Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with writer Chris Ballard about his new book, The Plunge. When Chris Ballard receives a cryptic text promising to extend his athletic life, he unexpectedly enters a hidden global subculture of cold water plunging and swimming, a parallel athletic universe populated by record-breaking grandmothers, rogue visionaries chasing Olympic legitimacy, and ordinary people doing extraordinary things together. Over 3 years of reporting and through hundreds of interviews, Chris Ballard travels from Italy to Ireland, England to Finland, Vermont to Copenhagen, tracing why humans across cultures and centuries have sought out cold water and what happens when they do. The Plunge is a story about endurance and community, about the body under stress, and about why, in a climate-controlled and screen-mediated world, so many people are choosing to do hard things collectively. Chris Ballard, a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for 2 decades, is the award-winning author of 4 books, including One Shot at Forever, and has contributed to National Geographic and New York Times Magazine. Chris Ballard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So, fascinating story, and something that you've really jumped into as well. I want to start with a scene, the first chapter, in fact. You go up to an event in Vermont and actually participate. Tell me a bit about that.
So this is a winter festival that they hold every year on the shores of Lake Memphremagog in Vermont. And this is right on the U.S.-Canadian border. So this is glacial water. It's this enormous lake. And it started about 10 years ago. And the idea was, let's go out on the ice of this frozen lake and take chainsaws, and we're going to cut into the ice and actually create a swimming pool. And then let's hold a swim race. And it started as a bit of a lark, but then it started drawing these people who really thought this idea was an excellent idea. Let's go swim a race in 34-degree water. And so by the time I got there in 2023, we're talking hundreds of people from around the world show up. And they swim, butterfly and freestyle and everything in this 33-degree water. And all they're wearing, and it's Fahrenheit, all they're wearing is goggles and like a silicone cap and a Speedo. And so this is technically known as ice swimming. And it's become this subculture. And what I realized was, if I'm going to write a book about this, I probably have to try it out myself. But this moment that I started the book with is probably the moment, sort of my now or never moment, because I standing on the edge of this ice and the air temperature is 7 degrees, and I'm seeing these people literally raking the water to get chunks of ice out of the way. And I'm about to get in there, and I'm realizing, okay, journalism has got me to this point. I probably have to get in this water, but everything my body said, do not get in that water.
And a guy you call Gandalf, I don't know his real name, his long beard. He says, take off your clothes and get in the water. That must be a shock when you get in there.
Unlike most sports, where it's like, take your marks, get set, go. The first thing they say is take off your clothes, because when you're out there in that air, you're wearing a giant swim coat. It's basically like wearing a towel around you, and you take that off, and then you got about a minute before you get in the water, and you get in and you start swimming. And for most people, getting in the water is the challenge. You start to hyperventilate. Your body essentially goes into fight or flight mode. This is a threat, right? And so if anyone who's taken a cold shower, gone and jumped in a cold lake in the winter knows this, you just, which is not conducive to swimming. So all these swimmers have spent time acclimating to get to the point where they can actually get in this water, put their head in it, and start swimming.
And it's fascinating subculture as well, right? A sense of community and camaraderie. A lot of, for example, up there in Vermont, eccentric people, regular people.
Yeah. And I think part of the allure of this is that it is so physically and mentally challenging that anyone who does it, there's a cutoff. And so immediately it's like, if you hang out with a bunch of ultra marathon runners, anyone who's going to be an ultra marathon runner probably has done training and committed themselves to it. Same thing here. So it's an immediate tribe and a feeling of like, oh, you made the club. And maybe it's an unusual club, but you're in this club now. Welcome in. And then secondarily, one of the swimmers I spoke to said it's almost like a manufactured crisis, because you're going into this really cold water and you're all surviving it together. So rather than feeling like you're competing with each other, you get out and it's like, we made it through. And so these people that are strangers that maybe you've never met before immediately become very good friends. And this is one of the reasons that, especially during the pandemic, so many people turned to cold water plunging and cold water swimming, because it was something you could do, you know, with other humans at a time when we're feeling lonely and anxious and powerless. And you could go meet and go swimming, you know, at the bay or the lake on Saturday morning and have social distancing, but still be together and share something. So this is that, but at the highest level.
We'll get into the science of this as we go along, but why do, as you talk to people, why do they do this? What do they get out of it?
Right. So I think there's sort of, if we're looking at a Venn diagram, there's three groups that are drawn to this cold water experience. The first are people that are doing it for their bodies. So this could be, I originally came to it for sports recovery. I was a midlife athlete. I wanted to keep playing basketball. And so for me, the first draw was, okay, maybe cold plunging is going to help allow me to play basketball into my 40s. So that was, there was people who were doing it for that. And there's people who are doing it as, oh, this helps me sleep better. My mood's going to be better. I'm going to feel more alert when I go to work. And that can be accomplished, you know, with a cold shower in your home in the morning. So it's that group. Then there's this group of people for whom any extreme challenge is catnip, you know, and maybe they've already gone and done an Ironman triathlon or whatever it is. And they hear about this world where people are doing these extreme things. The most extreme being something called the ice mile. And that is what it sounds like. It's swimming a mile in 41 degree lower water in just the cap and goggles. And in this case, you're essentially battling hypothermia as well as doing an endurance swim. And so they hear about this and they're like, okay, this is harder than Everest. You know, far fewer people have done this than have done Everest. This appeals to me. So the people who are always seeking out challenges, they want to push their limits. And the third group is what I was alluding to a moment ago, which is people for whom this provides relief. A lot of people in this world have trauma in their past. Maybe they've lost a loved one and they have found that going into the cold water, you really don't have any choice. You cannot think about anything else while you're in there. So you become fully present. It's similar to people who become really good at meditating. But for me, I've never been good at meditating. It's hard for me to sit still. So this is more of an action-oriented way to get to the same place, which is to feel whoosh, brain is cleared. I'm here. I'm in this moment. I'm outdoors. It's beautiful. I can feel at peace. And then there's a sort of an after effect to that as well when you get out of the water.
So that last group might include Tom Heyerdahl, the fascinating figure in the book. He was brought to this by grief, right? Was he seeking, I guess, peace through this?
Yeah. So Tom, Canadian, he lost his wife to cancer. It was a prolonged decline, and he was the caretaker. And he was, by this point, in his late 40s, early 50s. And one of the things that she said to him was, Tom, you know, when I pass, like, don't go dark. You can't go dark. But Tom still found himself after his wife passed. He gained weight. He was sitting inside. He's on the couch. He's in deep mourning. And so he starts with the idea of, okay, I'm just going to leave the house and walk around the block. And every day I'm going to force myself to get out and walk around the block. So Tom Heyerdahl, he goes and he does that. He's like, okay, I'm going to walk a mile, you know, and it, you know, he gained weight. He wasn't in great shape. So that's challenging, but he starts doing that. And then he's like, I'm going to go for a run. And so he gets to that point. And then one day when he's out on a jog, he comes across, this is in Canada, this lake, mountain lake. And he hears what he calls just absolute hilarity from down in the water. And it's this group of women who are out there swimming and laughing and having a great time. And they call down to him. They're like, join us. And he does. And he finds not only this physical manifestation of getting in that cold water, but this community around it. And he becomes a devotee of cold water swimming, to the point where Tom now in the winters, it's amazing. You can look this up, find a photo of him on the internet if you want. He goes and he carves his own pool and he goes in for 20 minutes a day out in this frozen lake. And this is his daily ritual. And it's a way for him to find peace and community and calm.
Let's have you tell your story a little bit. You got into this for one of the subsets here you talked about is athletic recovery. You were a basketball player for, I guess, many years. First of all, what did you get out of basketball?
Oh, so much. I know we were talking before this, Tom, about when you love a sport, all the buckets it fills for you. I know for you, it's tennis. And for me, it was not only, you know, athletic drive and fitness and exercise, right? That's sort of the baseline for it. But community, a lot of my good friends are basketball players. The camaraderie of it, the teamwork, the stress release you get from it. It had become my identity to a certain extent. I not only wrote about it for Sports Illustrated, but I continued playing long after college in every league I could find and on Sundays with my friends. And I wasn't ready I was 42 years old and I ended up having a hip replacement. And the doctor said, you know, Chris, you can walk, you can swim, you can go to the weight room, but you can't run and you can't play basketball. And on top of that, you got a 10-month rehab. And it hit hard. Like I fell into a pretty dark place because for me, not only could I not do the thing I wanted to do now during rehab, but I was being told I was never going to do it again. And I thought that would come at 60 or something. I didn't think that would come at age 42.
So you previously associated cold with injury, right? You put and you see athletes try to prevent injury or treat injury by putting ice packs on, etc. But this is cold plunging. I guess it's being adopted or been adopted by many athletes.
Sure, and that was where I first heard about it. Was an NBA trainer told me that LeBron James and Giannis and Steph Curry were using this technique, and it was different than traditional ice baths or icing an appendage, right? And it was like intense cold, 39 degrees, and you're going in up to your neck in a plunge tub, which activates something called the vagus nerve here as well. And then you're alternating with heat. And they had found that for recovery, it had really beneficial effects. A little bit like running like a pump through your cardiovascular system, just clearing out the inflammation. And I was like, hey, if it's going to allow me to play basketball, I am all in. So I started out by just trying it out myself. And that led to writing a story for Sports Illustrated about the athletes who were doing this and interviewing various people. And that's what led me down the rabbit hole, because I was talking to Klay Thompson, who was at the time the shooting guard for the Warriors, and he's now at the Dallas Mavericks. And Klay said, Chris, you know, I enjoy it for recovery, and it does help me get back on the court. But what I really like is that feeling afterwards, because if I go out in the morning and he kept his pool chilled through the winter, unheated, he would go out and the first thing he'd do in the day is he'd go out there, he'd stare at that pool and he'd work up the courage and he'd jump in and he'd said, and I hated it, but afterwards I loved it, because it was, on one hand, he felt great physically. On the other, as he put it, it's like the hardest thing you're going to do all day, and you just did it. And it took like 3 minutes, and you're proud of yourself every time you do it. So maybe he's in a shooting slump. Maybe he's bummed about something else. He goes out there, hey, I did that. I was like, that's interesting. You know, I'm curious. And so I started looking into that more and more, and that just led all the way to this rabbit hole.
As I was reading this passage about Klay Thompson, and learned that he got the idea from Tony Robbins, the Warriors brought Tony Robbins in. I thought, well, of course, Tony, you know, Tony yes, Robbins would yes. have this idea of the way, and that's what Tony Robbins said, right? You get up and you plunge into a cold ice, and that's the hardest thing you'll do all day, and you've already done it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's part of why this has become so popular in that part of culture. You know, you'll see, you know, Joe Rogan's got a plunge tub in his studio, celebrities, Kate Middleton cold water swims. There's a real appeal to it. And that has also come with it being a bit of a, it's an easy punching bag, you know, you're the cold plunge guy. And so that part of it was navigating the difference between, you know, the hype around it and then the real science and the real experience. And that was fascinating, to be honest, was to see people who had become just absolutely devoted to this practice. And then other people who just sort of saw it as something you used occasionally, you know, like break glass in case of emergency.
Well, let's take a brief break. Much more to talk about. Go back in history when we come back, and then learn about the science, Euripides, Benjamin Franklin, and of course, Benjamin Franklin would do this, right? You write in the book. We'll talk much more about this. Chris Ballard, the book is The Plunge. It's available now. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with writer Chris Ballard about his new book, The Plunge. It's available now, a fascinating book. A lot of interesting people, this fascinating subculture of cold water plunging and swimming. So, Chris Ballard, you mentioned that this goes back in history, not a new thing. Euripides to the Romans to Benjamin Franklin, who would swim in the Thames while living in the cold Thames while living in London. Writers like Keats, Byron, and Thoreau. Thoreau famously would dip in Walden Pond, right? So this goes back.
For sure. Yeah, there's always been this feeling that water and cold water in particular was linked to creativity and health. And you'll see this back to Avicenna, who talked about the stupefacients, which were the elements you could use to deal with pain. And so essentially, you know, like poppy seed, like heroin, essentially was one. And then ice was another. So we saw people tying these two things together for centuries and millennia. And then you had this real push in the 1700s into the 1800s around the idea of hydropathy. And this was the idea of using water as a holistic health approach. And so it starts in the Alps, and then it moves through Britain, and there's these seawater bathing clinics you could go to, and then it goes into New York by the 1800s, and there are hydropathy schools, essentially like medical school, but for hydropathy. And this is the idea that by submersing yourself in water, often by drinking a lot of water, using water in these various ways, that it could lead to increased health. And as you might imagine, there were parts of that got taken the wrong way. Ingesting seawater, for example, was probably not a good idea. They also would use this for, quote, baths of surprise in sanatoriums. So the idea was they thought that this could help someone who had a mental condition, obviously, scientifically not correct. But they were onto something with some of the base elements. And so what we did see was, you know, by the end of the 1800s into the 1900s, some of the more fantastical claims around this had moved away. But you still saw people coming back to it, and often for that idea of there's something about this that just makes me feel better. And we're not quite sure what it is. And it wasn't until about, you know, 1980s, 1990s that anyone was able to do the real hard science on it.
By the way, you begin the very first passage in the book, somebody named Bernard, he changed his name from Bernard to Bernard. I guess it was more macho, I guess, McFadden. 1903, Coney Island. Tell me about this.
Oh, fascinating man who's deserving of his own book. And so born Bernard, and he grew up sickly, and he lost his parents early. And so he decided that the way he was going to combat life was through physical vigor. And he's one of the first people in American history to really get into lifting weights. And then from there, he went to all these other practices that he believed at the time, and history and, you know, time has proven him right on a lot of them, would be good for you. He was one of the first people to be into eating a vegetarian diet, weightlifting. He also believed that walking barefoot was beneficial because your feet were in contact with the ground and thereby you're in contact with the earth. He liked to be naked. He skydived up into his 80s, and he wrote all these books about manliness. And so he changed his name at a certain point from Bernard to Bernarr, B-E-R-N-A-R-R, because he thought it sounded like the roar of a lion. And so you can sort of imagine this guy, his amazing pompadour. He ended up becoming quite wealthy and successful. But among the many things that Bernard McFadden decided to do, one of them was in 1903 to get a group of fellow people, all men, many of them the Coney Island strongmen, and wade out into the water there at Coney Island in the winter, in the cold, just in their swimsuits, or in some cases naked. And this was the origin of the famous Coney Island Polar Bear Club, which exists to this day and now has a big New Year's Eve plunge. And at first, as you might imagine, people thought them to be crazy, for one, but also to be just looking for attention, which might have been partly true. Mm. But I think over the years, that club grew and transitioned, and eventually by the 1940s, admitted women. And now it's this fascinating, eclectic, multicultural group in New York that gathers each weekend through the winter to do these plunges.
I love this little morsel. The New York Times sniffed that these polar plungers proved nothing except their desire to be talked about. That might have been partially true, but some of them I'm sure were out there for other reasons. Yeah.
Sure. Yes, for sure. There is an element to it. I mean, there is. It's undeniable that if most people don't want to go get in this cold water and you do, you get out and you do feel like, wow, look at me. Mm-hmm. That is part of the appeal.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the science. You talk about this. Tell me, first of all, about the 1-10-1 rule.
Mm-hmm. So a Canadian scientist named Gordon Giesbrecht, and he spent the 1980s researching sea survival. And so his goal was not using cold water for health. His goal, he's Canadian, was keeping people from dying in cold water. This was the majority of science we saw around cold water had been, how do you survive? How do you, if someone falls off a boat, if someone falls into a lake, how do you keep them from dying? And so this vast majority of the research is around this. And Gordon had done enough studies. Gordon actually, his way to find volunteers was to do it on himself. So he actually brought his body level down to hypothermia more than 30 times in his own experiments. Ethically, he didn't feel good doing them on other people. And through all this research, one of the things he found, and he coined this phrase, was the 1-10-1 rule, which is essentially that if you fall into cold water, like really cold water, let's say, you're out on a boat and you fall in, you have roughly 1 minute to calm your breathing. That's the biggest danger, is because you start to hyperventilate. And if you hyperventilate and you're actually underwater, you can drown. So this is the biggest danger in cold water, is going to be the first minute or so. So you have 1 minute to calm yourself. Then you have about 10 minutes. And that's that 10 minute period is when your body's still going to work pretty well. This is before your muscles start to freeze and brain fog sets in. So if you're going to make a break for the shore, for the boat, whatever it is, that's the 10 minute period in which to do it. After that, your hips are going to start to sink down in the water, and vasoconstriction's occurring. So all the blood is going from the perimeter of your body to your core to try to keep the heart warm. It's sort of like, well, we can sacrifice the fingertips if we need to. We're just going to keep the core warm, the organs. Part of what happens with that, though, is you become, it's much harder to swim. It's much harder to move. So that's the 10-minute period. And then the one at the end is you have roughly an hour, depending on your body type and a lot of other factors, temperature of the water, air temperature, before hypothermia is going to take you. And so in these winter situations, people would talk about the 1-10-1 rule.
Hmm. Of course, Titanic became the prime example of hypothermia, this kind of newish term of and danger. But it's kind of a paradox. Some people who had to jump died almost immediately. Others lasted longer. There's other examples you write in the book that some people are going for shore and in cold water and drown within sight of shore.
Yeah, I found this to be really fascinating because in the 1970s in the United Kingdom, they did these studies around water safety, and they looked at this weird phenomenon of all these people who were dying really close to shore, but they were good swimmers, and they couldn't figure that out. At the same time, they also had seen that if you put people into cold water, you would get this immediate gasp reflex. And so that's that hyperventilation I'm talking about. And so putting two and two together, this British scientist named Mike Tipton sort of investigated and realized actually the reason why the people that fell off the Titanic into the water and were assumed to have died from, quote, rapid hypothermia, weren't actually dying from rapid hypothermia. Because even in water that cold, the Titanic, it was salt water, so it was actually down around 28 degrees, which is very, very cold. But you're not going to die within 5 minutes, right? It's still going to be, 30 minutes to an hour. And so I realized the real danger was people were falling into the water. they're taking that huge breath and they weren't dying from cold. They were actually drowning. They were sucking in water. And so this led to in the late 1980s and 1990s, a campaign for people to understand the real danger was cold shock response. And this was what your body would do immediately going into the water. And yes, there is a danger if you stay in too long to the hypothermia, but that's not really you should worry about.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the beneficial, because hypothermia and the dangers, and you need cold water for any period of time. You need to be aware of the dangers. But you say that most pools are kept around 80 degrees. You know, you go to 60, 50, 40 degrees is kind of, the ice mile is around 40 degrees. So what's happening in the body, beneficial things happening in the body?
Sure. Technically, you don't need to go much below about 59, anything around there, 60, 59, you're still going to get a lot of the beneficial effects. You can go lower and you'll get different benefits. So let's start with the 60, 59 degree water. It's a spring day. You go jump in a stream or a lake and it's chilly and it takes your breath away. The first thing that's going to happen is you're going to get that shot of neurochemicals, which is going to be dopamine and noradrenaline. The dopamine is going to shoot up by about 250%. They have found in studies, the noradrenaline is going to be 530%. What that means in plain language is you're just going to be jazzed. You're going to be alert because your body's like, this is a threat. We need to respond to it. So anything external, we're not worried about. We're doing tunnel vision on the threat. So you get this crazy combination of being very focused in the moment and alert. So it's the same as your body, it's a house fire, there's a tiger that's approaching you, whatever it is, you need to be ready to react. So that'll occur at that temperature. And this is what a lot of people chase. You take a cold morning shower, you will find that this feeling of being alert and calm will actually last for up to 2 hours afterwards. So personally, what I do now is I'll do a cold plunge in the morning. I won't go in the hot shower after, and I'll have this period of work from 9 a.m. to 11 when I can be super productive. Because I feel that. Now, if you go colder, that's when you're going to get more of you're going to treat inflammation. So this is where if you have chronic pain, people who have multiple sclerosis will often use cold plunge tubs because that responds to cold. Heat is actually a way to trigger MS. So for people, especially in the summers, this is something that's a constant challenge. And they will actually wear freezable flak jackets, cooled bed sheets, anything to try to keep the body cold because of the way MS works. So one really good approach to that is going into a cold plunge tub. You're going to get that full body exposure to the cold, and they will find relief sometimes for half an hour, sometimes an hour, sometimes longer than that.
You report to some cold water swimmers say, I never get sick anymore. What's going on there?
I think I'll be honest with you, Tom. I think part of that is probably the belief effect, which is a nice way to say the placebo effect, which is real. It's about 10%. The studies around that are self-reported, and it is true that you'll hear swimmers say this. Now, how is it possible that you will not get a cold for 2 years if you're a cold water swimmer? It's possible. It does improve your immune system, but it maybe is not a safeguard. I wouldn't take this, I would still, wash your hands and do everything else you would do to not catch a cold. But what you find is each time you stress your body by going into that cold, you're activating your body's repair system. And it's the same as if you were to lift weights. You go into the gym, you lift weights, your muscle fibers will be torn, these tiny like micro tears in your fibers, and your body's like, oh no, we need to get ready for the next time, Tom or Chris is going to do this crazy thing to us. So in the intervening couple of days, through rest, recuperation, your cells will build back that muscle fiber and will build back a little bit stronger. That's the whole idea behind weightlifting. Same thing happens with cold water. And this is a concept called hormesis, which is that these tiny little stresses will make our body stronger. Too much stress, bad for your body. Tiny little stresses make it stronger. And that's what happens with the immune system.
One of the chemicals that increases apparently is dopamine when you're exposed to cold water. I guess that's why you have that high, that thrill.
Yep. And that's that's what a lot of people are chasing in it. Because, you know, often we get dopamine. You can activate it by going on social media. You can activate it by eating a cheeseburger. You know, you can activate in a lot of ways. But in a lot of those dopamine activations, what happens is either there's a flood and then a drop, right? So it's like an immediate high and then you feel like you need more of it. Or it's not an activity that you then later feel good about having done, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Here's something where it's a sustained dopamine boost. It'll last a couple hours. A, B, you're not going to regret, why did I spend 3 hours, you know, eating chips and watching Netflix last night? You know, it's a different approach to it.
One of the scientists you talked to talked about, and this is pulling back, talking about swimming in general. She said we're evolutionarily predisposed to water.
Yes. Yeah. So we are, if you think about it, you know, we're sort of, we come of being, we're essentially swimming, we're embryos, and we come out and almost immediately as babies, there's this fascinating response that a child will have where if you put them into water, their throat will close immediately. It's a gasp reflex. And this is a relic of when we evolved. We actually have these little, if you really look carefully into physiology, you'll see that the remnants of the gill slits that we used to have way back when, like way, way back when through evolution. And so we're both adapted for water, but not good at swimming in it. So if you look at, say, you know, a dog or even an elephant, and you were to take a young elephant or dog and just throw them into water, they will instinctively swim. Humans have to learn. So that's why, you know, there's a lot of dangers around drowning with people if you don't learn to swim when you're young. So we need to learn to swim. But once we do, our bodies will keep us, you know, relatively buoyant. A lot of animals are more likely to sink. And it's the sport we can do for the longest in our life because you don't have to worry about joint wear and tear. You know, if you're, say, unsteady and you're say, in your 80s like my mom and you're unsteady on land, maybe you need a cane. You get into water, it takes that gravity burden off of you. And it's a way it includes hydrocompression. So you're going to get like a subtle compression just from the water itself, which will increase circulation. So it's a fascinating, if you really get into the science, fascinating selection of things for which swimming is both good for and then challenging for.
Let's take another break. We're talking with Chris Ballard, and his newest book is called The Plunge. The subtitle is Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest, and the Transformative Power of Cold Water. It's out and available now. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We've reached our last segment with Chris Ballard today. He's author of the new book, The Plunge, Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest and the Transformative Power of Cold Water. I'd like to learn about some more fascinating people in the book, Chris Ballard. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Ram Barkai is a South African. Fascinating, fascinating fellow. Tell me about him.
Ram had hit a point in his life where he was at a midlife crisis. This is around the year 2000 or so. He had always been an athlete, and I can relate to this. His body was starting to break down on him. He was looking for something new. He found his way to swimming. He was in Cape Town, South Africa, and he'd been in business. And he's one of these guys who is always looking for a challenge. He had this saying, you know, in business, I wouldn't need to micromanage you if you didn't macro F up. So he had this sense of, you know, let's get to the point, let's take care of it. And so he got drawn to cold water swimming, and he found it first in Cape Town when it's a little bit chilly, and then he wanted to go colder. And so he heard about this group of people in Finland who were swimming in the winters, but they were swimming in little bobby hats, you know, with their head out of water, doing a breaststroke, and they might only swim like 25 meters, which is still, to be clear, really hard to do. But in Ram's case, what Ram wanted to do was really push limits. He wanted to swim longer distances. So Ram starts looking around and he's trying to figure out, how can I swim, let's say, a kilometer in really cold water? And this is the kind of thing that we don't know what's going to happen to your body, physiologically, physically, mentally. He's just drawn to this idea. And who do I go to? He finds this woman, Lynn Cox. Some of your listeners might be familiar. She's written books, Swimming to Antarctica. She wrote a book, Grayson, about swimming with a whale. Just a legend in open water and cold water swimming. She famously swam between Alaska and Russia. This was cited by Gorbachev and Reagan during the 1980s. And she's really the only other person who had done this. So Ron Barkai goes and he meets with Lynn Cox, and she gives him some advice. But really, her advice is don't do this. You know, you need to prepare. We don't know how it's going to affect your body. But Ron sticks with it. He goes and he swims this ice kilometer. Then he starts thinking bigger. And that's the beginning of this master plan he has that at first seemed pretty far-fetched, to start a whole federation around ice swimming, and then eventually to get ice swimming into the Winter Olympics. And 20 years later, I would say there's actually a non-zero chance, a 30% chance that they will pull this off. They have got actual Olympians swimming. They have, it's over 40 countries have federations now. It's been the German Swimming Federation, European Aquatics have recognized it. So it is becoming, from these humble origins, an actual sport. And for me as a writer, part of the interest I had in it was this is a story about this dreamer who wants to turn this, most people would say, crazy endeavor into an actual real life sport. What does that look like? What are the hoops you have to jump through? How do you follow this path? What's the outcome?
At a certain point, Rom decides, well, I need to, who can I go to recruit ice swimmers, right? Probably not going to be the pool, but there's a whole group of open water swimmers. So not as big a jump from open water to ice water, right?
Yeah, there's a huge, and I was not a swimmer myself, so I had to learn this firsthand. There's a huge difference between people who swim in pools where, you know, it's 80 degrees, you have a lane line below you, you go back and forth, you do laps, it's great exercise, it's fun, nothing wrong with it. But people who take on open water swimming, that means, you know, the water temperature could vary widely. There's marine life, as Elaine Howley, one of the swimmers, says, you know, things with teeth that are below you. There's tides, there's current, there's boats. There's just a lot to deal with. So it is both the physical challenge you get from swimming, from in a pool, but then this whole mental component. And that's what draws people to it, is that it is, you are out there and you're, to a certain extent, you are just a speck in this larger body of water, and you are in this ecosystem, you're a tourist. And that is appealing because now you're navigating it, right? We're in control with so many parts of our life. Here you are a little bit out of control, but finding you sort of have to go with the ocean. So those personality types are the ones for whom, if you said, you know, if they're busy swimming the English Channel already, he said, well, what if we, you know, what if you swam in 38 degree water? Is that a challenge you'd be up for? Those are the type of people that didn't say immediately, oh, heck no, right? There's a group of the swimmers who were like, immediately, like, no way, I'm not doing that. Others who were like, tell me more.
One of those was Elaine Howley. Tell me about her.
Oh, yeah. Elaine is amazing. I'm doing a book event tonight in Boston, and Elaine is going to be my conversation partner because she knows this world as well as anyone. She herself was a college swimmer at Georgetown, and she herself, through living in Boston, became interested in open water swimming, and then through open water swimming, found her way to cold water and ice swimming. And she has swam the Triple Crown, which is three of the hardest channel crossings in the world. She has swam an ice mile, one of the first women to do it, remarkable woman. And she also has become sort of the mom for ice swimming. She is the one that everyone goes to. And there's this wonderful part of swimming in which you are both doing something yourself, but you're also helping others. Because Tom, if you were to decide to swim, you know, 10 miles in a local lake or whatever, you wouldn't just go swim 10 miles. You would have a kayaker next to you. And if you're going to swim, let's say, English Channel, you need a boat and you need all this support crew. And Elaine is famous for being that person who is in that kayak next to you, who is on that boat, who is providing support, who provides a community, who, when you finish that really cold swim and your fingertips are so numb you can't use them, will pull the swimsuit down for her friends, right? So she has become that figure in it. And as a writer, what I'm looking for is an expert, someone who can guide me through a world. And Elaine was entirely that person for me.
And she got into this through, I guess, grief and tragedy originally, I think, right? Her sister died, and she went from being, what do you call it, crewing, right? That's the kayak, right? Getting in the water herself. What have you say a little bit about the equality, women and men in marathon swimming? Women routinely beat men in marathon swimming.
It's fascinating. It's probably the sport where you will see the more women not just competing with, but beating men than any other sport. And the longer the distance, the more that equals out. So if you're going to do if you watch the Olympics and you're watching a 50 meter sprint, yes, the men can pack on more muscle and they will do better than that 50 meter sprint for sure. But the longer distance you go, the more the advantages for women come up. And part of that is physiologically. So if you think about, say, Michael Phelps, who has these, you know, amazingly long arms, he has all these advantages for swimming and sprinting. He's also incredibly lean and his body fat is low. And so most of what Phelps is doing is he's trying to keep his body up. So he would just sink, you know, the muscle will just sink. The fat distribution is not great in men. When they do gain fat, they tend to gain it right in their belly, a little bully ball kind of thing. Whereas women, their fat distribution is better. And they tend to just generally carry more body fat. So as you'll find, rather than sinking, far more women will actually come close to being buoyant, and not on top of the water, in which you have to sort of force yourself back down, not below it where you're trying to force yourself back up, but neutrally buoyant. So now you're not fighting to go up or down, you're just swimming with the water. So that's one advantage. The second is the mental component. This is something that there's been studies on, but nothing definitive yet. But that we have seen that psychologically, in endurance sports, women have advantages men don't. And one of the great characters in the book explained it to me. She's like, you know, of course we do. We go through childbirth, right? there's an ability to go through pain and suffering that is an advantageous thing when you are swimming 20 miles in open water.
Just a couple minutes left. I want to have you talk about this idea. We talked about it a little earlier in the program, but underline this. I'll quote this from the book blurb. In a climate-controlled, screen-mediated world, why do so many people choose to do hard things collectively? I guess it answers its own question, but talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, it's no surprise that the last 5 years, this has become really popular. As we have gone through the global pandemic and there's instability, and on any given day, the news might freak you out, and social media and artificial intelligence, all these things about which we have no control. So our stress now is psychological, not physical, because, you know, you could sit in your office all day and go home to your house where you keep it at whatever you like, 72 degrees, whatever your preferences, you don't have to lift a finger and you can be completely successful in life without any physical stress. Instead, the psychological stress is going to hit you. So part of the allure of the cold water is that you're returning to a physical stress, and it's one that you can essentially handle, right? So if I'm anxious, if I'm worried, a lot of that are things I can't control. If I'm like, I'm going to get into this cold plunge tub, I'm going to take a cold shower, it's going to take me 1 minute, I have to work up my courage to do it, and then I can do it. And afterwards, I have achieved this. That is a validation. It is a resilience building tool. And it is something that is relatively simple in a world that's become incredibly complex. And I found this myself in doing this. After doing it for 3 years, my ability for emotional regulation, let's say I'm on a long flight, I'm in the middle seat, I can handle that much better than I used to, because I've now essentially trained my body step by step to be like, okay, we can handle this. We can handle this.
Just 30 seconds. Earlier in the book, you issue a precaution, consult your doctor. Don't just jump into cold water swimming. The precautions, I guess.
Yes, for sure. Anyone who's interested in doing this, you first, I mean, if you take a cold shower, you're fine, right? But if you want to do cold water swimming, what you should do is get a workup from your doctor. There are some underlying heart conditions that can be triggered, especially if you have not acclimated to cold water, and arrhythmia in particular. So for example, for these ice swimming competitions, everyone needs to get both a physical and an EKG. You want to get that baseline there. You shouldn't do it alone. There are not only the dangers of the cold, but once you get out of the water, you will endure what's called afterdrop. And that's when actually your body will get colder 5 minutes after being in that water than when you were in there. But that's part of the allure of it is because you can't do it alone. People need to come together in groups to do it. And so these are strangers often, but it creates communities where you would not otherwise find communities. And the whole barrier to entry is only, hey, are you coming in the water with us? And then afterwards, you have a cup of tea, you know, a hot cocoa, whatever it might be, and you create that bonding effect. But for sure, get yourself checked out, read up on it. Never dive in if you have not been acclimated to cold water, or even if you have, I don't advise it, because two things happen at the same time. One, you're going to trigger that gasp reflex, and you might end up sucking in some water. And secondarily, your heart's going to start racing. So there's two things. You want to just wade in, and then when you're breathing calms, then you can start swimming.
Well, fascinating book. Much else in the book. You'll have to go and get it and read it. The author is Chris Ballard. The book is called The Plunge, Maverick Swimmers, An Unlikely Quest and the Transformative Power of Cold Water. Chris Ballard, pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Tom.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.